Now, so Aseres Adibris are the synopsis of the entire Torah. And that's why Matan Torah, the giving of the Torah, is the event during which what happened during that event? Aseres Adibris were given, because that's the synopsis of the whole Torah. Not only quantitatively, but qualitatively. It's not only they have 620 letters. Qualitatively, in Aseres Adibris, we have the entire intensity of Torah, the entire essence of Torah. So therefore, the Alter Rebbe is saying that the Aseres Adibris are higher than Malchus of Atzilus, because Malchus of Atzilus reveals the Ein Sof light to the world. It's Gilui Ein Sof to the world. And the Aseres Adibris really contain the essence of Torah that transcend even the formulas of Torah that it assumes during its descent. Aseres Adibris captures the pristine, original, quintessential quality of Torah, which is Chachma of Atzilus. And this is the reason, Taka, what the Alter Rebbe explained in chapter 52, that the Torah can act as a garment that doesn't become nullified in the light of the Shekhinah which garbs itself in it, because since its source is higher than the Shekhinah, it doesn't get nullified in the presence of the Shekhinah. However, in order for the Torah to act as a concealing garment, it has to descend lower than the level of Shekhinah, thereby enabling the light of the Shekhinah to be received by the created beings. But in Aseres Adibris, you had the pure intensity of the Torah, which is higher than Shekhinah. You'll ask a question. The Ten Commandments also descended to assume a logical structure. The Ten Commandments are not a reflection of Atzilus in its purity. If it would be so, we wouldn't be able to relate to it. We could understand the Ten Commandments. So they also made the same descent that all other parts of the Torah made. Not only that, they made a descent to the extent that they descended to become physical letters and physical words engraved in physical tablets. So they made that same descent that the entire Torah made. Chabad of Bria, Chabad of Yitzir, Chabad of Asiya. So the Alter Rebbe adds, Okedei lechakakam beluchas avanam gashmim, in order to engrave them, the Ten Commandments, on material tablets of stone, lo yarda mimadrega lemadrega. The supernal chachma, the Torah, did not descend degree by degree. Kederech ishtal shalul sa'ilam asadaylam azagashmi, parallel to the order of the evolution of the worlds, which descend by stages from a higher world to a lower world until it reaches this material world. Generally, there is a process of evolution of the worlds. When the divine flow of the Shekhinah arrives to a particular world, it goes through a process of evolution. For the Shekhinah to arrive to this physical world, the Shekhinah descends from world to world. In each world, it becomes more tangible, less aloof, less sublime, until the Shekhinah enters into the world of Asiya through the Chabad of Asiya, and then through Malchus da Asiya, it creates the actual creatures of the world of Asiya. So he says as follows: Kiyoy lemaze hagashmi misnai bislapshus ateva hagashmi. This material world functions through the garb of material nature. Our world has laws. We call them the laws of nature, which govern and mandate our reality, the reality of our physical world. How does this happen? Because the divine energy that sustains this world evolves from one level to another level to another level to another level, until it assumes the Shekhinah that is relevant to the nature of the world of Asiya, and thus it creates the patterns of this world that are defined by particular limited, defined laws that are extremely definable and articulate and have causes and effects in a very physical and structured and organized, limited way. But what about the luchos, v'haluchos, the tablets, ma'ase elokim heima, they are the work of Hashem, v'amichtav michtav elokim hu, and the writing is the writing of Hashem, shalom ma'ilam me'ateva shalom hazagashmi, which transcends the nature of this material world, ha'nishpa, our material world is derived, me'ha'oras hashchina, from the radiation of the Shechina Shebehech al Karchi Kadashim da Asiya, which dwells in the shrine of the Holy of Holies of the world of Asiya, Shemimena, which from her, from that shrine, from the Shechina in the shrine of the Holy of Holies of Asiya, Nimshech Or v'Chayis Lo'olam Asiya, light and vitality issue forth to the world of Asiya, Shagam Olam Hazeh B'Chlaloi, in which this physical world is also included. Olam Asiya itself is multidimensional. There's the spiritual Olam Asiya, and Olam Hazeh is also B'Chlaloi. This physical world is part of Olam Asiya. So the body of this physical world gets its energy from its soul through what? Through its brain. What is its brain? Chabad of Asiya, Kachi Kadasham of Asiya. What encloses itself in the brain? The Shechina that relates to the world of Asiya, which is Malchus of Atzilus evolves to Malchus de Bria, to Malchus de Yitzira. That encloses itself in Kachi Kadashim of Yitzira, which is the in Kachi Kadashim of Asiya, which is the brain of Asiya, and it allocates the energy and the vitality to this entire world. And therefore the body of Asiya has rules, just like the body of a person has rules based on its own brain. The body of a frog has rules based on its brain. The body of a salamandra has its rules based on its brain. The body of Asiya, the organism of Asiya, has its rules based on its brain, based on Kachi Kadashim of Asiya, its anatomy, its qualities, its nervous system, and the energy that it houses, which is the Shechina that relates to Asiya. And that organism has to function in a particular way based on its capacity, based on its anatomy, based on its brain and what goes into its brain. And therefore, everything in this world falls under the laws of nature and cannot escape these laws, because its entire identity it receives from where? From its brain, which is Kachi Kadashim of Asiya, from its Shechina, which is Malchus of Yitzira that's in Asiya. And there's nothing that's an exception besides one thing, the Luchas. What's the luchas? The luchas are a physical object, physical tablets of stone. So he says, well, what is the nature of the luchas? They were produced, they were manufactured by a different reality. This is what he says. Ella, what are the luchas all about? What happened by the luchas was as follows. The level of chachma of atzilus, shehi klolus ha-tayra shebiyud ha-dibris, consisting the totality of Torah as it's encapsulated in the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments encapsulate the totality of Torah, not only quantitatively, qualitatively, as I mentioned. They encapsulate what Torah is, and that's the highest level of Chachma. So this Chachma, Nislapsha, closed itself, b'malchus da'atzilis u'debriya levadah. In the levels of Malchus of Atzilus and Bria alone, they didn't evolve further. The Chachma didn't evolve further in Malchus of Yitzirah and Malchus of Asiya. Only in Malchus of Atzilus and Malchus of Bria. Vehein levadin, and they alone. What is they alone? Chachma of Atzilus as garbed in Malchus of Atzilus and Malchus of Bria without any further vestment. Hamiyuchad is ba'edin seif shebeseichan. United as they are with the infinite light, with the light of Ein Sof that is within them, Hein Anikrayus B'Shem Shechina, this reality, these dimensions of godliness, we refer to when we say, when we talk about the Shechina, Hashayre B'Kachi Kadashim, the Bayis Rishon, which dwelled, which rested in the Holy of Holies of the First Temple, Al Yidei Yislapshus B'Yud HaDibris, through its being vested in the Ten Commandments, HaChakukais, B'Luchas Shaba'adim B'Nez, which were engraved by miraculous means, in the tablets reposing in the Ark, Omai Se'elekim Chayim. And these Ten Commandments engraved in the tablets were the work, were the handiwork of the living God. And he says in parentheses, Hu almadis kasya. This refers to the concealed world, Hamakanan b'olam habriya, which nests in the world of Bria, k'noida liyodei chachan, k'noida liyodei chachman nistar, as is known to those familiar with the esoteric discipline of Kabbalah and Jewish mysticism. You understand?
Because of the material, because of the vessel to receive it was Luchas.
Okay, now maybe you can explain it to us.
Very simple. If its vessel, if it's got a very high vessel, then it doesn't have to play by the regular rules. It's not because it's a very high vessel, so you can make miracles. Does that play by the regular rules?
Right. He quotes here the pasuk of Parshas Kisisa. When he describes the luchas, he says, "Haluchas ma'isa l'kim eima michtav michtav l'kimu." Parshas Kisisa describes how Moshe Rabbeinu came down from the mountain with the two tablets of the covenant, and he says, "Haluchas ma'isa l'kim eima ha michtav michtav l'kimu." The luchas were Hashem's handiwork, and the script was the script of Hashem. Says the Alter Rebbe, although the tablets were physical, which means you can see it with your eyes and touch it with your hands, the hallmarks of physicality, yet their physical structure was not defined and it was not enslaved, it was not subjugated to the laws of nature that govern all physical substances. It was l'mayla me'hateva agashmi. As he put it in his words, he said that it was b'neis. The Ten Commandments were engraved in the Ark miraculously. And what he's referring to here, obviously, is what the Gemara brings out in several places. The Gemara says in the beginning of Masechta Megillah, Masechta Shabbos, Daf Kuf Dalet, Mem v'samach shebelucha is b'neis hayu oimdin. Two letters in the tablets, Mem and Samach, stood miraculously, which means as follows. The Ten Commandments were engraved in the stone of the tablets through and through. Not partially, but through and through. Now, if that's the case, the circular letters, Mem and Samach, are the only two letters that are completely sealed. If the stone is engraved through and through, the center of these letters, Mem and Samach, the middle part of these circular letters, must remain suspended in the air. All other letters, you understand, all other letters, even though they're engraved through and through, they're connected to different parts of the tablets. You can engrave an Aleph through and through. You can engrave a Beis through and through. When you have a Mem, we're talking now about the Shloss Mem, the Mem Sofit, the square Mem, not the other Mem. The other Mem is not a miracle. But the Mem and the Samach, since these letters were engraved through and through, and they were circular letters, hewn, engraved through the entire stone, how did the middle part stand? Engrave a Samach or engrave a Shloss Mem through and through. You have that middle part, so you engrave it in the stone through and through, but it remains suspended in the air. How is it supposed to stand? It's not connected to any other part of the tablet if it's a Mem and a Samach. So the Gemara says, Mem v'samach shabaluchas b'nes hayoimda. They were there miraculously. They can only stand by a miracle. Another miracle the Gemara brings out is as follows. Since they were engraved through and through, you would expect that if the letters were engraved on one side, if you would read the letters from the other side, they would have to be in reverse. Yet there was an amazing thing about the tablets. The writing was not reversed on either side. Naturally, one of the letters on one of the sides needed to be reversed. But from both sides, you can read the letters in an identical fashion. This is the reason why the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos in the fifth chapter that there were 10 things created Friday, Bein Hashmashos, Friday during twilight, in those special moments when we make the transmission from the mundane week to the sacred day of Shabbos. And one of the things the Mishnah says is Haksav, Hamichtav, Haluchos. So the Bartanur explains what is the Michtav. The Ksav, he says, are the letters of the tablets. Mem, the Samach. The Michtav is the script of the tablets in the sense that it was read from both sides in an identical fashion, and then the tablets themselves. As the Tosfos Yom Tov there quotes the Asara Mamaris, that Hayez a Maisa Bilti Meshura B'Sichleinu. The structure of the two tablets, it was a physical structure, but it was incomprehensible through our rational mind. So the Alter Rebbe explains, how did this occur? So what is his point? His point is as follows. Usually, what is felt in the identity of every creature, or every reality, from a mineral, a speck of dust, a flake of snow, a flower, a rose, an animal, a human being in this world, it's the energy that comes through Malchus Da'asiyah, from Kodesh HaKadoshim of Asiyah, from the brain of Asiyah, from the Shechina that relates to Asiyah. And that energy is what defines us. It defines our experiences, it defines our laws, it defines our anatomy, it defines our organism, the entire structure of Asiyah. Each creature according to its laws, but there is a pattern in which we're defined. What about the physical structure of the tablets? Their nature was that it was super. They were supernatural. Why? Because they were a physical product that was not manufactured through the entire evolutionary process of the divine energy. What happens is you have the Chachma of Atzilus, which is the Ten Commandments, encloses itself in Malchus of Atzilus, which is the Shechina. That encloses itself in Malchus de Bria, and that produces the physical tablets. So basically, the physical patterns of the tablets reflect the Shechina of Bria, which is a whole different type of divine energy, a whole different level of divine energy. It's a whole different level of consciousness. And therefore their laws are totally different laws. Yes?
I read in the Sefer Talaitis that furthermore the letters of Lucas were three-dimensional, and as a result the Samach you're talking about was really like a ball shape, it was spherical, and the Mem you're talking about was a cube. Mm-hmm.
So you're saying the letters in the tablets were three-dimensional. From who? The Talaitis, you said? So the Mem was like a cube, you say.
And
the Samach a ball. He's just defining it. What does the Gemara mean in Shabbos? Mem v'samach. But nesa yoyim din, you simply had a ball and a cube. So this is the level of Shechina that dwelled in Kodesh HaKadosh, in the Bayis Rishon. So first of all, you had the Aseres HaDibros. You had the Aseres HaDibros, which is Chachma of Atzilus. Even the Aseres HaDibros, as they evolved to assume physical letters and to assume a logical formula, he says, what was it? It was Chachma of Atzilus in the Shechina, in Malchus of Atzilus, which then enclosed itself in Malchus of Bria. And this was the Shechina that was manifestly felt and expressed in Kodesh HaKadoshim of the first Beis HaMikdash, by them enclothing themselves in the Ten Commandments that were engraved in the tablets. And that's why he says it's called Maisa Elokim Chayim, because Elokim Chayim in Kabbalah is the reality that we attribute to Olam Abriya, Alma Diskasi. It's known as the concealed world, unlike Yetzirah and Asiya, which are known as Alma Dizgali, as the revealed world. Not to confuse with the fact that Malchus Datsilis also calls Alma Dizgali. It's two different realities. Here he's talking about the worlds themselves. There are higher worlds and lower worlds, concealed worlds and revealed worlds. But the source of all of the world is called Alma Dizgali. That's the Shechina Malchus Datsilis, just not to confuse the two things. That's why he mentions this about Elokim Chayim. So the Luchas were a product, where Maisa Lekim Chaim were a product of Bria. They weren't a product of Malchus the Yitzirah through the brain of Asiya. They were a product of Malchus of Bria. No, that's the whole point. If they would be B'derech Hishtalshalos, they wouldn't have these properties. They defied the properties of the physical world because they were a product their product was not produced through the natural evolution of the worlds. There was an evolution, but of a different degree completely. So Malchus of Bria, which is the Shechina, dwelled in the brain of the physical world, which is Kodesh HaKadoshim, where the Torah was. The Aseres HaDibris became now the brain, the cosmic brain of this world, the Torah, Chabad, in which the Shechina, Malchus Datsilis and Malchus the Bria, dwelled, and that is what produced and manufactured the physical tablets as well. And that was expressed in this Kodesh, the Kodesh HaKadoshim of the physical world. Now the Alter Rebbe continues about what happened in the second temple. It's a different level. And what's happening now. But that will continue next week. A little more than dessert we need now. We need the real thing. Just... to try to apply a little bit what Alter Rebbe is saying here. You know, at the surface it seems so abstract and removed. When the Torah defines the Luchos as Ma'aseh Elokim, the handiwork of Hashem, you may ask a simple question. Tell me, the cell of a body is not the handiwork of Hashem. The solar system is not Ma'aseh Elokim. Just look at a piece of grass growing from earth, or an embryo developing into a fetus, developing into a child. That's not Ma'aseh Elokim. A drop of rain is not Ma'aseh Elokim. What was unique about the Luchos? And why do we say that in the Luchos there was the Hizgalus HaShechina, the indwelling and the revelation of the Shechina in the Kodesh HaKadoshim of this world? You say it was the Shechina. And in the rest of the world there's no expression or dwelling. The rest of the world is not a dwelling place for the Shechina. For the Shechina. On the contrary, it may be an exile for the Shechina. Who made the rest of the world? You can ask the same question on Torah. We call Torah the word of Hashem, Dvar Hashem. We call Torah the wisdom of Hashem. But the whole world is also the word of Hashem, and the entire world expresses the wisdom of Hashem. The wisdom of physics, of astronomy, of mathematics, of biology, it's the wisdom of Hashem. So there's a lot of ways in which we can address this question. But what the point Alter Rebbe makes here is one, and a very important one. There's a major difference and distinction, and this is what we call Hishtalshalus Ha'olamos. If something is a product of Hishtalshalus, or it's not a product of Hishtalshalus. If something is a product of the evolution of the world or not. Let's explain, let me explain. Everything that exists is a product of Shechina. Be more precise. Everything that exists is a product of Ein Sof. But that nobody relates to. So we talk about Shechina. Everything that exists is a product of Shechina, which means it experiences Shechina in some form or fashion. Shechina begins with Malchus Datsilis, descends to Malchus Debriya, Malchus De Yitzira, and ultimately Malchus Da'asiya. The world we're familiar with, which includes the cells of a body, a drop of rain, an embryo, a speck of dust, and a piece of grass that grows from the sand, are products of the evolution. It's the Shechina that descends into Malchus Debriya, Yitzira, Asiya, and in every world through the brain, including the brain of Asiya, and then it produces the embryo or the nerve cell and so on and so forth. Besides the Luchos, besides the tablets. What is it about Malchus d'Atzilus that it defines it as Shechina? What about Chesed of Atzilus, or Gvura of Atzilus, or Teferis of Atzilus, or Netzach of Atzilus? So I explained to you previous weeks as follows. Atzilus is also a universe, but we don't call that Shechina. Why? We call it a world, but the Alter Rebbe doesn't call it Shechina. Where is Aschala's Gilui Ein Sof in Malchus d'Atzilus? Why? What about Chachma d'Atzilus? What about Chesed of Atzilus? What's the answer? The answer is in Atzilus. We define Atzilus as a world because in Atzilus we have all the building blocks of the whole world. In Atzilus you have the entire world in its pristine form. But there's one thing about Atzilus. We call it a divine world, a world of Elikus. The Alter Rebbe put it earlier, it's Elikus Mamish. You know why? Because over there, the entire world is within God. Over there, the world is experienced. But the definition of the world of Atzilus is a world that is submerged in Hashem, in its creator. You have there all the building blocks of the world that will produce everything in the world, including grass and embryo and rain. But in Atzilus, which we call the spheres of Atzilus, the attributes of Atzilus that are the building blocks that ultimately form and sustain the world, there they're godly. What does it mean they're godly? There they don't have a distinct identity outside of Hashem. They're qualities of divinity. They're an expression of Hashem. Something happens in Malchus that is very, very dramatic. You know what happens in Malchus? In Malchus, otherness is introduced. And this is very important to understand. Malchus, by the way, is one of the, I can express myself thus, is one of the most favorite words in the Alter Rebbe's discourses. What is Malchus? So to encapsulate briefly what we discussed 1 week more at length is as follows. You could love intensely and genuinely in the absence of the one you love. On the contrary, in the famous slang, absence makes the heart grow fonder. Which means you can be isolated. You can be alone. You can live in your own world and really love. Not just a fantasy, a hallucination. You're really in love. Although the one you love so much is totally absent. And may forever be absent. I hope not, but that may be a possibility. But I have another question. Can you have the following question? Can you say that somebody should be alone in his own world, in his own domain, and yet he should be married? No, he should get married. I'm not talking about that. I mean, obviously the person can fantasize that he's married, but you're not going to call that marriage. You will call it love. You could say this person is in love. You can't say this person is married in his own mind. Why? Marriage necessitates another human being. You can't have the experience of being married without another human being. You can have the experience of love without another human being. In practicality. You can love in your heart. You can't give in your heart, could you? Love could be imaginary. Giving can't be imaginary. Because you're not giving, right? In order to give, I can't imagine that I'm giving and you'll say, this person is giving. Giving, you have to give. You need another person. Love is not about another. Love, you can love another person in your own world. As long as Hashem's qualities are defined by love or by compassion or by aggressiveness or by bonding, you're still not dealing with Shechina. There's no need for a world. There's no need for anything other than God. When Hashem chooses to define Himself as Malchus, as a Melech, Malchus is always defined as the feminine quality, it's defined as speech. This necessitates otherness. If you want to be married, you need another person. The person has to be outside of you. So when Malchus d'Atzilus is the definition of godliness, as it can become, as it's defined as a source for otherness, for something outside of himself, for the world. You have the world in Atzilus also, but that's not a distinct world. That's godly. That's the world as it's swallowed up, as it's submerged in the godly reality. In Malchus, you already have a new identity. Godliness as a source for a world outside of Hashem. Yet, if Malchus of Atzilus was exposed in its full intensity in our presence, we would also be nullified, just as the rays of the sun within the sun itself are not seen. So the Shechina, Malchus Atzilus, must also be garbed. And therefore it has to evolve and develop and become more eclipsed and more eclipsed, and its intensity must be diluted until it can produce Briya and Yetzirah and Asiya. But everything ultimately is a product of Malchus Atzilus. That's where the break occurs. That's where the transition, the metamorphosis between Einoid Milvadoi, between there's nothing outside of godliness, and self. That metamorphosis is created in Malchus of Atzilus. If Malchus Atzilus itself would be revealed, it would still, the world would be swallowed up like the rays of the sun in the sun. But that moment, Malchus is the most dramatic moment. That's Malchus of Atzilus. Now, the question is, how much otherness is felt in the world? The more Shechina evolves, the more it becomes diluted, the more it becomes eclipsed, the more the worlds perceive themselves as self-centered. Until the Shechina hits the world of Asiya, the Shechina of Yetzirah, which becomes enclosed in Kodesh HaKodashim of Asiya, which becomes enclosed in Malchus of Asiya, and then creates this world. And what happens in this world? In this world, of course, everything is Ma'isel Lakim, and everything is Chachmas Hashem, and everything is Dvar Hashem. But what happens in this world is that everything has a dual quality. Everything has a dual interpretation. This world is like a novel that has a double meaning. It's like a metaphor that can be explained in two different ways. You can view a human cell and say, wow, what a God. You can view a human cell and you can say, wow, what a random explosion can produce. Every event, every phenomenon in this universe can be interpreted in two ways. You can look at an event in the world and say, look how history develops. And you can look at an event in the world and you say, Yad Hashem Asa Zois, this is the divine hand in providence. Man is a messenger who can easily forget the message. The world is a novel that can easily eclipse its theme. The world, the universe, is a metaphor that doesn't necessarily tell the story that the metaphor is supposed to tell. There's no reality in this world that cannot be explained without God. There's always the ability to deny the presence of Hashem in this world. There is no phenomenon. There is almost no event in this universe that doesn't eclipse godliness. Somehow, some form, some fashion, you can rationalize it. You can define reality as something that is detached from godliness, from spirituality. If there wouldn't be ishtalshalus, if there wouldn't be this evolution, a person would walk into this world, look in the mirror, and what would he see? He would see Tzelem Elokim. He would see a reflection of divinity. What ishtalshalus did was, it imposed a distortion. It's like if you go to amusement parks, you know, you can go into these mazes, and you walk in these mazes endlessly, and you don't know where you're going, and the mazes have mirrors, and they confuse you even more. You ever went into these mazes? You still go into these mazes?
No, I'm in the right place.
Now. And these mazes have mirrors, and some of the mirrors are big, so they magnify your face. Some of the mirrors reduce your face. But the bottom line is, they don't expose who you are. So a person walks into this world, he looks in the mirror, and he finds himself in an endless maze, and endless mirrors that either magnify who we are or reduce who we are. But the true nature of what is reality and what is a human being is extremely eclipsed, it's extremely concealed. So you can say really that the world is like a jigsaw puzzle of billions and billions of pieces. It all begins in Malchus of Atzilus, but in this world, the jigsaw puzzle is totally squandered and totally fragmented. I mean, imagine somebody creates a jigsaw puzzle of billions of pieces and then scatters it all over the world. So you take one piece of a puzzle, you don't see that it's a part of a puzzle. It's just an isolated piece. And it's our job now to reconstruct the jigsaw puzzle. To come into such a world, a scattered world, an egocentric world, a fragmented world, and discover the inherent harmony and godliness and spirituality that is in it. To show the big picture, the picture of the Shechina in it. This is what the evolution did. It diluted the energy until it can create a universe that totally doesn't reflect the Shechina in any way in its own perception. Says the Alter Rebbe, there always remains one point in the world in which there's no distortion. There's one corner, one island in a dark universe in which there are no doubts, no dualities, no fragmentation, in which there's clarity. There's one oasis, one island in an endless turbulent sea that is translucent, it's transparent. And those are the Luchos HaBris, the tablets of the covenant. Ma'isa l'kim heima v'amichtav michtav l'kim heima. V'amichtav michtav l'kim. In a physical cosmos that is continuously fluctuating and is completely distorted, there was one point, Kodesh HaKadoshim, in which transparency reigned. She reflected the origin of the universe, Malchus of Atzilus. In every other part of the world, there is cloudiness. There is opaqueness through a partition that doesn't allow us to see who we are and to see what the world is. There's one passageway in reality which is not cloudy and which there is no distortions. And over there, the world was perceived for what it really is. The Kvod Hashem, the presence of divinity, was present there. One point, one island, one transcendental island in space, a spiritual island in which there are no distortions. That's the Luchos. Doesn't come through that Holy Shtashlus. You look at the Luchos, you look at the Holy of Holies, and there's clarity. Why is that needed? It's very obvious why that is needed. Because without that, the human being, the religious human being, as well as the secular human being, remain torn forever. For the very simple reason. Someone once told me, a teenager once told me, well, he said, you know, he says, you can't live with God and you can't live without God. Why? To live without God, which is what the secular world tried to do, dismiss the notion of a creator, dismiss the notion of a designer and so forth, leaves us with a void. It leaves us with a void. Its symptoms are well known. Boredom, anxiety, depression. So live with God, but to live with God is also very difficult because He's not to be seen anywhere. What is to be seen is physicality, materialism. And our consciousness is not drawn to God. Our consciousness is drawn to materialistic pleasures. That's why dismissing God seemed like a brilliant option. Because if you dismiss God, basically you can follow all of your cravings and you don't have any responsibilities. The problem is, by saying that things don't have ultimate meaning, only in a very limited context, which means there's no God. When you say there's no God, it means things have no ultimate meaning. They're just an accident. They only have meaning in a limited context. Liberates the person, but it also leaves him with a very, very profound void. But then to go to God is also a very frustrating experience because you keep on denying what you see. You keep on denying your own cravings, your own ambitions, your own natural urges and lusts that are very unholy. And this is the struggle that Torah intro. It's a very deep struggle that every serious religious person has to deal with. And every serious not religious person has to deal with in another, in an opposite extreme. So the Alter Rebbe says, there's one corner in the world where there's transparency, where there's no duality, where there's no doubt. When you look at the Luchas Abris, you look at the Kodesh HaKadoshim, it's one oasis where the man who's constantly tormented by an opaqueness, by a wall that never allows him to see God. So he can't live with him and he can't live without him. When he looks at the Luchas, there is a sense of clarity, of a vision. It allows him to redefine his own life. Without the luchos, the darkness can be overwhelming. And that's the one point in reality, one point in the cosmos, he says, that was not distorted. Everything else is distorted. And that's very, it's intrinsic for the Jew to have that. Because that allows him to continue in his own life and to go on. This is the meaning behind the story, and this is what I want to conclude with behind the following story. The Baal Shem Tov lived in a city called Mezhebush. I mean, it's quite a story. And it's this chapter in Tanya that explains to us the meaning of the story. The Baal Shem Tov lived in a city called Mezhebush. Before he arrived in Mezhebush, the spiritual preacher, the Magid, known as the Magid Meisharim of Mezhebush, which means the spiritual mentor of the city who would teach and educate and illuminate and rebuke and enlighten the community, was a great spiritual, pious, learned scholar, a great Talmud Chacham. His name was Reb Ze'ev Wolf Kitzes, known as Reb Wolf Kitzes. When the Baal Shem Tov came to town, he lost his job. Obviously. He wasn't a competition to the Baal Shem Tov. A candle is beautiful, but if you light a candle during midday, as the Gemara puts it, Shraga Batir Mahani, when you have the light of the sun, the candle becomes superfluous. Reb Wolf Kitzes recognized who the Baal Shem Tov was, so he immediately became a disciple and a student. And he submitted his entire authority to the Baal Shem Tov. He became a true student and chassid of the Baal Shem Tov. But a job he didn't have. Being a real Yid, he yearned to go to Eretz Yisrael, to take his family and make Aliyah, to go to the Holy Land, which was the custom of many pious Jews in that during the day, including the Baal Shem Tov's own brother-in-law. And that was the wish of the Baal Shem Tov as well, as we know. He also wanted to go to Eretz Yisrael. And his brother-in-law, Reb Gershon Kitever, went to Eretz Yisrael. So Reb Wolf, as a student and a faithful disciple does, goes into the Baal Shem Tov and says, Rebbe, can I go to Eretz Yisrael? The Baal Shem Tov says no. A little while later, the urge increases, it becomes even stronger. He goes in again to ask, and the Baal Shem Tov refuses. A few times he asked, and each time the Baal Shem Tov said no. Finally, after a year or two, he couldn't contain himself. He couldn't silence that urge. He decided he's going to Eretz Yisrael with or without the consent of the Baal Shem Tov. The custom then was that Jews would leave their hometown on Friday morning. They would say when the dough of the challah was rising. That's for whatever reason, that's when Jews would leave their city and they would stay somewhere for Shabbos and they would continue their journey after Shabbos. So Friday morning, the entire home was loaded onto a wagon. His entire family, his wife and his children, and the Wolf Kitzes, they were on their way. They left Mezhburg. They were planning to arrive next city for Shabbos. And then Saturday night, Mitzvah Shabbos, they would continue the journey, most probably till Turkey, where they would take a ship from Constantinople, from Istanbul, and arrive to Yafu or to another port in the Holy Land. His mazel, that Friday morning, the Baal Shem Tov was returning from a journey from outside of Mezhburg back home. So when the highway that left Mezhburg, the Wolf Kitzes, is in a coach with his family, with furniture and books and boxes, and the Baal Shem Tov in his coach is returning, right? He's a two-way highway, he's coming the other way. He sees his chassid, he turns to him, he says, stops. He says, Wolf stops. He says, Wolf, who gated? Where are you going? A real human being he was. So he says, Rabbi, I decided I'm going to Eretz Yisrael without your consent. I just can't contain my urge. I'm going. That's it. Baal Shem Tov smiles and he says, listen, I'm not going to stop you. Wills gain for Gesundheit. You want to go to Eretz Yisrael, Gegezun? I just have one request. Before you leave, spend Shabbos with me. So the Wolf says, Rebbe, I would love to, but everything is packed on a wagon, and we're on the way to the next city. He says, I understand. Come back to Mezhburg for Shabbos, and then you leave after Shabbos. So he says, Rebbe, you know my financial situation. In the next city, I already made all of the arrangements with a coachman. I simply don't have the money to come back, to stay here, to pack up again, and to leave. I don't have the financial means. I'm barely making it to Eretz Yisrael. The Baal Shem Tov says, Allah hitzas of my cheshbon. All of the expenses, the eating, and the hospitality, it's all on the house. And the Baal Shem Tov says, Kailul hitzas amarchas. Including the expenses for bathing Friday afternoon before Shabbos, Jews would go to the public bathing house in the city, and it costed money. He says, I'm going to pay for it. Nope. With such an offer, you know, it's an offer you can't refuse. He goes back. Baal Shem Tov puts him up. Baal Shem Tov tells his family, they put him up with his family. And the wagon comes to a halt in Mezhburg, and he's going to leave after Shabbos. He goes to bathe on the Baal Shem Tov's cheshbon. The Baal Shem Tov goes to bathe. After bathing, the Baal Shem Tov turns to him and says, Reb Wolf, come with me to the mikveh. Come with me to the mikveh. The Baal Shem Tov would go to the mikveh Friday. Every day, I think, the Baal Shem Tov would go every morning to the mikveh, and he would go Friday. When the Baal Shem Tov came to the mikveh, everybody left, obviously. Nobody was in the mikveh. But the Baal Shem Tov invited the Wolf particularly to come with him to the mikveh. Now such an offer you certainly don't refuse. So he went into the mikveh with the Baal Shem Tov, to the pool of water where the Baal Shem Tov would immerse himself Friday before Shabbos. The Baal Shem Tov goes into the mikveh and does what he does. The Alter Rebbe in his Siddur has a whole discourse known Kavanas HaMikveh Al Pi Baal Shem Tov, the meditations that one ought to have when he immerses himself in the mikveh that were revealed through the Baal Shem Tov. If you read those Kavanas HaMikveh Al Pi Baal Shem Tov, you just see, you know, it's a humbling experience, what we don't understand. So you can understand what the Baal Shem Tov's mikveh was. Baal Shem Tov leaves the mikveh and he waits in the room and he says, Reb Wolf, it's your turn, go to the mikveh. He goes into the mikveh. He's there for a while. He comes out of the mikveh. He tells the Basham to furnish the Eretz Yisrael. I'm not going to Eretz Yisrael. He comes home. He tells his family the trip is canceled. We're staying in Medjugorje. They say, what happened? He tells them the story. He went into the mikveh. Reb Wolf himself was a spiritual giant. He wasn't a nobody. He was a spiritual giant, a big, big scholar and a very pious man. When he immersed his head, when he dipped his head in the mikveh, his eyes were closed. He saw a vision. In his mind's eye, he experienced a vision. The vision is he arrives with his family by boat to the Holy Land. He comes onto the soil of the Holy Land, Eretz HaKadosha. He bends down and he kisses the soil, the earth of Eretz Yisrael, which was the custom of many great tzaddik. And not tzaddik, many Jews. The first thing he asks by the people who welcome him, he says, where is the road to Jerusalem? Take me to Jerusalem. They throw him onto a coach and they rush him to Jerusalem, and he's eagerly anticipating. He says, when will I be able to see Jerusalem? And they say, a little longer, and we'll be there. A little more, and we'll arrive. He says, suddenly I see the vision of Jerusalem. Yerushalayim, Ir HaKadosh, Kiryas Melech Rav, the capital of the Ribbono Shel Olam, the capital of Hashem, of the Jewish people. He arrives into the city of Yerushalayim. He jumps over the coach. He kisses the earth of Yerushalayim. And he said, I was transported into another world, the world of Yerushalayim, the holiness of Yerushalayim. I turn to the people around me and I say, take me to the Har HaBayis. Take me to the mountaintop where the holy temple stands. They rush me to the Har HaBayis. He says, I see the Har HaBayis and I'm transformed. My heart is just metamorphosized in ecstasy. I run up to the Har HaBayis and I turn to the people and I say, where is the Beis HaMikdash? Where is the Holy Temple? And they point, there is the Holy Temple. I run into the Beis HaMikdash. He says, I'm in the Beis HaMikdash. The dream of my life, the raison d'etre, the purpose of my life has been established, has been materialized. He says, I'm so happy, I'm so full of gratitude. I sense the divine, but I say, one second, where is the Kodesh HaKadoshim? Where is the Holy of Holies? So they point to the western side. And I rush and I rush and I see, I mamash see the wall of the curtain covering the Holy of Holies. And I run into the Kodesh HaKadosh, into the holiest place in the whole universe that Alter Rebbe describes. And I turn to the people near me and I say, where is the Aron? Where is the Ark? They point to the Aron. I run over to the Aron and I'm touching the Aron. I'm touching the embodiment of the Shechina itself, of divine itself in this world. And my soul expires, it melts away in sweetness, B'noyim Hashem. And I take the kapiras, the lid over the ark, and I lift up the kapiras, and I'm ready to gaze at that article, that one article that reflects and embodies the presence of Hashem Himself in this world, the Luchos HaBris, the tablets of the covenant. And I take a look and I see the Luchos are gone. The tablets are gone. They're not here. And I'm torn to pieces. I can't believe it. It's like the pinnacle, the quintessence of the world is just disappeared. It's like, one big shell. And when you come to the bottom line, it's just not there. It's nothing there. So I turn to them and I say, where are the luchas? Where are the luchas? They turn to me. They say, the luchas, the tablets, they are immeasurable. They're immeasurable. That's what he saw in the mikvah. So he came out, he tells us, the Baal Shem Tov Amar, I'm not going to Eretz Yisrael. I'm staying here in Mezhebush. Now, if a Litvak is going to hear this story, how does a Jew speak like this? How does a Jew speak like this? So Hashem helped. There's nothing in Chassidus that doesn't have its source in Nigla, in Gemara, or in Medrash that was written by the Tanaim and the Amiraya. So I see the whole thing says explicitly in Medrash. In Medrash Rabbah and Shir HaShirim, Parsha Aleph Pasuk Gimel on the Pasuk L'Reyach Shmanecha Toivim, the Medrash says that Rebbe Lazar had a Beis Medrash. Rebbe Lazar had a yeshiva. It was a very big Beis Medrash. And there was a stone in the Beis Medrash where Rebbe Lazar would sit. He would sit on that heaven. Pam achas nichnas Rebbe Yeshua. Once Rebbe Yeshua, who was a colleague, a student and a colleague of Rebbe Lazar, walked into the Beis Medrash. Hischil menashik oisah ha'evan. He began kissing that rock. And he said, Ha'evan hazoi is doim lahar Sinai. This stone is comparable. It reflects Har Sinai, the Sinai Mountain. Nu, v'zeshe yosav ala doim laharin habris. And the one that sat on the stone, Abelezer has passed away by then. The one that sat on the stone, Har Sinai, is the stone. The one that sat on the stone, he's doim laharin habris. He embodies the Aron HaBris that were given on Har Sinai on the heaven. This is what it says in Medrash Rashidah. What's the meaning behind the story? And what's the meaning behind this Medrash? As exile continues, that which the Luchos represents gets forgotten. I mentioned before the importance of having one place in the world that's not distorted. So how do the Jewish people, how does the world remain inspired? How do we not lose hope? How do we remain focused in such a turbulent sea, with such opaqueness, with such darkness? When you have Bayis Rish and Akadosh HaKadoshim, Luchos HaBris, the world zafaltzich, the world zabrekeltzich, the world crumbles like a cookie. But there's one place in which you see that there's a bigger picture, that there's a God, Yesh Bala Bayis. That all of your strivings and your fight for morality is not in vain. But as exile continues, you don't have that. So therefore Hashem gives to a generation, a human being who in his flesh and blood embodies the stones and the engraved letters in the stones of the tablets, Luchos HaBris. So these people in their flesh and blood embody a place in the world where there is clarity. The Luchos. They're not a product of Ishtalshalos. So when you look at the person, they embody one corner in the world in which there is translucency, in which there is transparent. So when you look at the Baal Shem Tov, you look at a Rebbe, what do you see? You see who you really are. You begin to define yourself in the world in terms of Shechina, rather than in terms of an egocentric, materialistic, dark, and hopeless universe. Have a good night and a wonderful week.
To order additional MP3 CDs, call Heichal Menachem at 718-633-1076 or visit us at www.chassidus.com. That is chassidus.com.